Coming up, a special episode of the Ideas Lab podcast, What It Means to Be, presented by Dr. Yan Wong.
Hello and welcome to this Ideas Lab Predictor Podcast special edition on what it means to be safe. We've got four guests ready to throw caution to the wind and get the discussion started, so let me introduce them. Austin Rodriguez is Safer Places Officer for the Birmingham South Community Safety Team. Phil Loach is Deputy Chief Fire Officer at the West Midlands Fire Service. And from the University of Birmingham, we're joined by Dr. Chris Allen from the Institute of Applied Social Studies and Dr. Danielle Beswick from the School of Government and Society. Great to see you all. So I'm going to kick off by asking, do you feel safe? Hopefully right now you do, but in general. Phil?
Yeah, relatively speaking, I think so. I feel safe. A lot safer after the instructions around the fire precautions in the building this morning. But yeah, generally, yes.
Everyone feels quite happy, I guess, by the look of it. They're all nodding. Well, we went out and about and asked the people we met what made them feel unsafe.
What makes me feel unsafe? Being out of control.
Uncertainty.
Groups of kids on corners, because you never know if they're the nice ones that are just hanging out or they're the ones that are going to start shouting at you, throwing things.
Hoodies. Anyone else who looks like they're up to no good, sort of people loitering for no real reason in the middle of the day.
At night when, like, you know, like gangs and stuff are out.
I'm quite scared of the dark, so I think I'm more scared at night time.
Being on my own in the dark at night.
Alleyways, sort of areas for someone to hide.
If somebody was apparently following me, and especially if they had a hood up.
Many a time I've walked home early in the morning on my own, but I've never ever felt unsafe in this country at any time, almost like wearing blinkers.
I think it's knowing that there's something to be scared of that makes me feel unsafe.
Whereabouts we live, I feel very safe. If I'm in somewhere like Manchester, I don't feel very safe at all.
There's some places where you know not to go because of the reputation.
I'm actually an ex-doorman, so I'm quite handy, so I don't feel unsafe if I'm walking down the street. If you don't put yourself in the situation, then you're generally all right.
So there seems to be quite a lot of people with a perception of being unsafe, especially with meeting people on the street who they're not sure of, things on street corners and things like that. No one mentioned, for example, being afraid of fire, yet we've got a fire officer here. I guess that might be a much greater threat than being assaulted by someone on the street. Is that right, Phil?
I don't know whether it's a much greater threat, but I think it would be safe to say the key word that you use there is around perception and people's perceptions around safety. We've used as public agencies in the past a lot of data around actual crimes, and a lot of things have been referenced there, and they're not proportional to that perception, that fear of safety.
Austin?
If you look at it in terms of the question, what it means to be safe, there's two bits, people actually being safe and then the actual very personal feeling about actually feeling safe. You know, sort of following what Phil says, if you look at sort of crime levels across the country, in particular areas where there's always been high crime, it's actually reduced consistently over the last sort of 10 years, but the gap between people feeling safe and the crime level coming down hasn't really narrowed. So actually, I think when we sort of look at this question, I think it's down to personal feeling in terms of where you are, in terms of country, age group.
So what can we do about it? I mean, if there is this sort of gap in perception, is there anything, does education help? Chris?
I think it's more about fear. And I'm not quite sure how you tackle fear, you know, because once people become scared of something, whether that's, you know, from we heard from the clip, whether that's the dark, whether that's sort of a hoodie, whether that's sort of certain areas, actually becomes very difficult to actually tackle that, because, you know, once you're fearful of something, you speculate, you exaggerate, you know, and things become much worse than they actually are. And the kind of, there's a huge disparity between sort of the reality and the perception. But it's really fear that I think that drives that.
And do you think that's worse because of, for example, modern media, where people can find out about these things, horrible things, obviously. We've had recent bombings of mosques and stuff like that going on. But maybe 50 years ago, you wouldn't necessarily know that that had happened.
Well, I can give you an example. From after the 9/11 attacks, the Los Angeles Times, its heading a few days afterwards would be that fear would be the next big thing for the West. And of course, previous to that, they'd used headlines like apocalypse, you know. And, you know, so actually, you know, what we get is, you know, it's that there is this recognition that fear is dangerous, but also the media does tend to speculate and exaggerate the threat from all of these issues as well.
I think there's generally a sort of since people fear things which they don't understand or they don't sort of know. So a typical example would be older people and young people. So older people generally throughout whatever age of human history, older people don't understand young people's trends. So from that, you sort of see the demonisation of young people hanging around the street corners, and Mrs. Miggins phoning up to say there's kids hanging around the street corner. Now, to someone else, to another young person who might see the same incident, it's just young people hanging around the street corner. It's a perfectly safe situation. But to Mrs. Miggins, it's actually there's a potential threat and risk there because she doesn't understand actually what's going on in that situation.
And that points to a really good follow-on from what Chris was saying as well, that the gap between fear and actual threat is knowledge. So if you understand what's going on, if you feel that you have a reference point, you can engage with a realistic assessment of how likely you are to be hurt, to be, you know, under fear of physical violence or any other form of violence, then you can make a realistic judgment about your own personal safety. But if you don't have a complete picture of why that person's on a street corner or who they are or what they're doing, then you can't make a full decision or a full assessment.
So do you think lots of it's about knowledge, you sort of assume that people have more access to knowledge nowadays because of the internet and media and stuff like that. Has that made it any better? Personally, I can't imagine that it has.
Well, I think people have more access to information, such as via the media, sort of social media, but not as many connections as they used to with other people. So, for instance, people generally won't know their neighbour two or three doors down. They won't use their park as much as they used to and sort of meet maybe other dog walkers or other people in their neighbourhood. So that's possibly where the gap lies. We know more, but we don't understand as much, don't understand the place where we live and are connected to.
And just echoing that, that's maybe the differentiation between information and knowledge is that there's more information out there, but what tends to drive the media is information around the negative aspects, you know, so that then becomes the norm as opposed to people understanding different groups. I mean, a group of people wearing hoodies on the stand on the end of the corner is not antisocial behaviour, but because we have a fear of that, then, you know, it's driven through the media.
I was going to say, I can give you some statistics that kind of reinforce that. And research was published in 2007 looking at the representation of Muslims and Islam in the British media, and it increased by 240% over that 10-year period. And then when you actually start to look at whether that was positive or negative, around 95% of those stories were negative. So around presenting a threat, around terrorism, about being other or different to who we are in Britain. And then when you look at some other research, which was done by the Islamic Society of Britain, around 2/3 of people find out all they know about Islam and Muslims from the media. So, of course, that creates there the disposition to actually sort of speculate and exaggerate and kind of go, well, you know, all Muslims must be bad because that's what the media is telling us. And I think you're absolutely right. It's not about knowledge, it's about information.
So we get a sort of distorted picture from the media sometimes because absolutely. It reflects certain things and not in a necessarily a balanced way, I guess. Danielle, is that different in, I know you're a specialist in Rwanda, I guess, the society must be a bit different there, and they have the sort of neighbour connections that we seem to have lost a little bit. But presumably they don't have access to media and the internet in the same way as here. So
it varies quite substantially, I would say. And in Rwanda, you have the specific legacy of the 1994 genocide. So there was this genocide that basically destroyed a lot of the connections between communities and within communities as well. So you have a legacy of mistrust, which means that there are these suspicions about our people here to continue the violence and to finish what they started. Within communities, even though when you look at the actual figures on attacks on genocide survivors and such like, they are relatively low, and there's a very impressive level of personal security and very low crime in Rwanda compared to a lot of other developing countries. So again, the perception is perhaps out of kilter with the actual threat. But I think what we sort of seem to be doing here is assuming that there is an objective idea of safety and what it means to be safe, that if we just have the right information, the right kind of information, and make perfect decisions, then we can feel safe. But actually, nobody knows what that perfect decision-making material is because it's different for everyone. Yeah.
So what do the people we spoke to think are the biggest threats to their safety in the UK? So it might be interesting to hear what people say, because I wonder if it really is distorted. Here you go, listen to this.
I can't remember the last time I genuinely felt threatened.
The web.
At night when, gangs and stuff are out.
According to my family, the big threat to me is me, because I'm completely and utterly accident prone.
Probably my smoking.
I don't feel there's that many great threats in the UK. It's pretty alright.
Getting public transport if you're having to get it late at night and you have strange people on the bus, that's always a worry.
Living in a big city is going to be terrorism.
It's probably still road safety. That's probably where I'm at. Biggest threat.
Phones, everyone's always carrying around their iPods. iPads are the tablets that I think people who are looking to steal those things are aware that most people will have them.
At midday on my local railway station, I was mugged and my purse was taken, and it shocked me rigid.
So that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because they're the last clip someone had very personal experience, and obviously that's going to affect you a lot. But then there were other people saying living in cities, terrorism, and then someone else saying roads, which I would have thought, I mean, Phil, you probably know better than the rest of us, that roads are presumably one of the major things that's going to cause you problems, road deaths, road accidents.
Yeah, I think in terms of emergencies, road safety is now taking over as that primary cause for serious injury and death. Probably significantly as well, it's got the least developed prevention strategy around it as well. You know, personally, I think, and as a fire service representative, we believe that there is a direct link between the prevention and the actual incidents that happen. And because we haven't got that developed prevention strategy around road safety, that is an indicator locally and nationally that's probably heading in the wrong direction.
So do you think we should be forced to do something about it? Do you think the government should implement laws, for example, like seatbelt legislation? Is there a role for government to try and force people to carry out safer behaviour?
Probably there has to be a dual approach here. I mean, if you go back to the first seatbelt legislation, preceding the seatbelt legislation was a very long campaign about encouraging people to put seatbelts on. It was when the law came in that probably had the biggest impact, but now people, if you like, forgot about the law and it becomes a behaviour. All prevention for me is around behavioural changes. You know, to use a very simple analogy, not in road safety, but in fire, you fit a smoke detector to protect somebody, it won't actually stop them, you know, having the fire, being careless with smoking materials or unattended cooking. It will just protect them. But there needs to be an ongoing identifying the vulnerable people and attempting to change their behaviours over a period of time.
I guess that's sort of in the news at the moment with things like minimum alcohol pricing, that you know, that there are things that you can implement. But and some people like that and some people don't like the sort of government intervening in that way. Chris?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's an interesting point here around prevention is when it deals with people or when it deals with practices. When it deals with a practice, it kind of goes across all different communities. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the Preventing Violent Extremism agenda, which emerged after 7/7, obviously, what you've got there is you've got a governmental policy, which in many ways was seen to be targeting one specific community. And of course, that then reinforces a lot of the stereotypes that are already being put through the media. So you have a very dangerous kind of situation, as obviously you need to do something in terms of prevention and trying to stop extremism. But how do you do that in such a way that actually, you know, you don't actually tarnish, you know, a whole community? And I think it's interesting this idea about, you know, a kind of dual approach, because in many ways it's about targeting the practice or the behaviours. But you know, when it comes to people and communities as well, that you have to find some way of actually bringing those communities in as well. And I'm not sure we've got that right yet.
So there's a sort of human psychology element that you need to consider whenever you implement any sort of policies or changes like that. Austin?
I think there's also a balance though between what the role of the state is and what the role of the individual is. I mean, if you look at another sort of area of legislation, like antisocial behaviour legislation, loads of different powers have come out from that, and it's changed what the police and sort of local authorities do. And it's actually raised expectations from individuals about actually what they should be getting involved with and what the state should be getting involved with. And you know, if you sort of compare people's responses to what they should be picking up and dealing with in their own street to sort of more recently, they'd be saying, well, actually, that's something the local authorities should be dealing with, kicking a football in the street, friends and supporters. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, it would have just been something which is sort of let by. So, again, it can be sort of quite a blurry line and blurry. So if you look at road safety as well, there's already quite a lot of legislation. So how much of it is personal responsibility for actually adhering to speed limits and adhering to the drink drive limit, and how much of it can you actually sort of legislate for as well?
So we've been talking about the state and the role of the state. Presumably in places like Rwanda, where there was a major serious problem of genocide, which is obviously horrendous early on, then that must mean that there's a role for a large body like the state to come in afterwards to try and smooth the waters, as it were, and implement policies that work. What happened?
I think it does. Rwandan genocide creates this really interesting set of questions about who is responsible for safety, particularly from physical violence and armed conflict. And in the Rwandan case, the government's been seen as a very good performer in terms of delivering physical security, reducing crime rates, preventing the continuation of civil war. If we look at statistics on civil war, over half of countries experiencing civil war relapse into conflict within 5 years of the first conflict ending. So there is a huge premium put upon states and regimes that are able to break that cycle. And in Rwanda, we've seen that the role of the state. But the state has provided this level of physical safety, but at the same time, it's done that by limiting space for political expression and also partly been implicated, well, heavily implicated in involvement in conflict in Eastern Congo. So you have this question about displacement of insecurity and safety threats from one place to another.
I guess we're fortunate in the UK, aren't we, that we haven't had any civil war for a long period of time or any sort of major conflicts, I guess, post the Second World War. And so we haven't had to tackle those issues. We've had a relatively long period of stability and we have journalistic freedom and that sort of thing.
I think there is the bigger point that is relevant, though, is this question about displacement. So if you introduce mechanisms to increase safety in one area, are you potentially creating safety and security threats in another area? And I think that links back to Chris's point about this policy around prevent. So if you demonise or are seen to demonise a particular community in the eyes of the population, regardless of whether that was your intent, you generate a future expectation that that community is a security threat.
In terms of Muslim communities in Britain, I think many would say that there's a direct link between the rise in extremism in this country and British foreign policy.
You mean Muslim extremism?
Yeah, Muslim extremism. But there's very few politicians who will actually even engage in that discussion. And I think that there you create a kind of vacuum that can be easily filled by the voices of extremism, whether that's those from within Muslim communities or also those from within, say, the far right as well. And the far right will draw upon, you know, making links between Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, all these other places where there's conflicts that are primarily Muslim. And they will make direct links with the behaviour of some Muslims, just a handful of Muslims in this country. You know, so this vacuum that's created really does create problems for us in terms of our kind of safety, security and, you know, the fear levels that kind of come with those.
To me, that sounds like there's a lack of knowledge and information about what's going on. If people can generalize so much as to see sort of the entire foreign world as a threat, then is there a role for education or something like that, do you think?
Well, I think it becomes problematic when you start talking about things such as the Muslim world the West. You know, these are hugely homogenous terms. And what's really interesting is that when we get into debates about Europe, Britain doesn't want to be a part of Europe. And yet when it's about the Muslim world, we're happy to be a part of the West, you know, which means we are with all Europeans. So, you know, it's the terminology we use as well. And the extremists from both the far right and also from within Muslim communities as well will use this language. They will talk about the Muslim world and the West, you know, as if these are two homogenous blocks that are always going to be in conflict with each other. And it is sometimes about actually breaking that down and saying, well, the reality is that's not really true.
I mean, I do remember one of the things that really struck me was I was reading a book about the Crusades and the degree of diversity within the Middle East, between even separate cities within the Middle East, is enormous. And they have completely different attitudes run by different people. And there's a sort of turnover and there's a whole history there, which we're never really exposed to. And we just tend to think of it as a sort of homogenous group of people who all believe in the same thing. And it's not at all any more than Europe is, I guess.
I think in the sort of vacuum area, I don't think people have tried to almost rewrite history, I suppose, if you look at sort of the far right. I think fairly recently BNP tried to use the Spitfire, for instance, as one of their logos and sort of going out in their campaigning a few years ago. But actually when you sort of try and educate children in school and you try and get them to understand the history, for instance, certainly in the First World War and the Second World War, I think the first Victoria Cross that was ever given out was in the First World War to a Sikh soldier from India, for instance. And actually when children start to understand that, then you start to break down those barriers which people have tried to exploit, I think.
And I think when you look at some of the kind of discourse of the far right, I mean, it is quite interesting when they start talking about England and Britain. And, you know, it really is a kind of a nostalgic kind of entity from maybe 200 years ago. And if you look at most young people, you know, in this country, most will have been born and will have grown up in quite a diverse environment, you know. So I think that, you know, these notions, increasingly people won't associate with them. Younger people, you know, research research has shown that younger people don't identify with, you know, Britain or England being particularly a purely white country or a white entity. It's much more about a diverse mix. And I think that, you know, increasingly these sort of things will become more meaningless. But then again, that creates challenges for us in trying to set out a definition of who are the British and who are the English. And actually, that's one way of actually countering the kind of message of the far right.
And do you think that feeds into our feeling of safety as well?
Well, I think a loss of identity creates fear. And I think that there is maybe an argument in terms of wider society, where, you know, this kind of, you know, what is Britain now? You know, where is it going? Where will it be in 50 years' time? What will the landscape look like? What will society look like? I think these create real anxieties for people. And I think that goes right across, all communities. I don't think it's the preserve of a white community. But I think that, you know, we live in a time and a society where change happens so quickly and rapidly that, you know, it creates anxieties, and I think that we do need to sometimes acknowledge that, and also I think politicians do as well.
Well, I guess we can hear from some people who are talking about what they feel threats to their safety is in the UK.
I think the greatest threat to safety in the UK today is probably terrorism.
I think terrorism. The social deprivation is going to be something, or whatever causes people to go out and decide that they'd like to mug you.
Outside influences. Outside wars and things like that. People have grudges against the UK.
Road accidents.
People's driving. Idiots that drive in the snow at 50 miles an hour and all these fancy newfangled cars being made without indicators, you know, because apparently if you've got a car that costs over 50 grand, you don't need to indicate when you go around a corner. It's fine.
I think we're coming back to immigration and the fact that people feel threatened by what they don't understand. They see an influx of immigrants and feel threatened by it.
That is very much what you're saying, isn't it? That it's the sort of people's perception of the foreign and the things they don't know.
And change as well, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, even though we've lived in an increasingly diverse society over the last 50 to 60 years, you know, since the first waves of mass migration, I think what we see now is a much quicker change, and that diversity is much more kind of multi-layered, you know, and we're now talking about sort of, you know, people coming from, you know, almost every country, you know, across the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that the last statistic showed in Birmingham, for example, there's over 180 different nationalities, you know, whereas 50, 60 years ago, it would probably be about 10, you know, in terms of migration. So, you know, so trying to understand and kind of comprehend the scale of change becomes quite anxious for people.
I think so. If you look at Birmingham as an example, it's sort of meant to be quite a diverse city, but it's also quite a segregated city. But actually, for the first time over the last 5-10 years, you've actually seen some of the population start to mix due to sort of needs around housing. So potentially sort of around some of the suburban white areas. Now there's changing population with Pakistani sort of families moving in, Somali families moving in. That's something which these communities haven't seen before. So again, that's where some of the change happens. People don't understand change and fear the unknown. And again, sort of leads to that sort of speculation and vacuum for people to exploit, I think, as well.
Do you think that's positive in the long term, though?
Long term, that's got to be positive.
Yeah. And if you were in charge, as it were, of the country, what can you think of one thing that you would do to either improve safety or maybe even the perception of safety? What would you do?
I think the ownership of personal weapons. I think people tend to be killed more by their own knives than by other people's knives. Certainly, I think if you look at America in terms of gun ownership as well, I think if we continue to go down that path, I think that would be the right one to do.
You mean you're anti-people having their own weapons rather than pro? Oh, yeah. I should highlight.
just to cover that, yeah.
Yes. Anyone else, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I because I've been talking about fear and about perceptions a lot, I'm going to send out a very British message and say, keep calm and carry on, you know, and to be balanced, to look at these things objectively, to try and put things into some sort of perspective and try and find out what the real picture is and, you know, don't fall for the stereotypes and hype.
Yeah. Phil?
Yeah, I think reiterating what I've said before, really, is I believe that it has to be a dual approach. For it to be sustainable around safety, it has to be a change in behaviours, and that's probably finding opportunity to raise people's awareness, to be more of that melting pot and integrating as opposed to almost the segregated communities. You know, as a non-academic sitting, it's quite a complex issue, and just looking at it almost a layperson, you know, if I had to address it in a very simplistic way, it's get people talking to each other.
Danielle?
And obviously my area of research is outside of the UK. It's more on the international arena. And I think with that in mind, there's a discussion going on at the moment about what should replace the Millennium Development Goals, which are about defining how development money should be spent in the next 10, 15, 20 years, however long. And I think I would argue for encouraging and including a reflection on security and safety within those, an explicit one, because they've been traditionally focused on human development targets around maternal mortality, education, etc. I think something around the reduction in armed violence or crime would be a welcome addition to that.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. I get the feeling everyone is actually quite positive about our future safety and our perception of it. Is that right, do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Broadly so. Well, that's an optimistic note to end on. Thank you very much indeed.
This Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was presented by Dr. Yan Wong and produced by Lucy Vernal and Sam Walter. It's part of a series from the University of Birmingham.